Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
Have accessed entry 990.LK0240, certificate number 50285. Prodigies, comma, failed.
That's 72 unforced errors for Richie Tenenbaum. He's playing the worst tennis of his life. What's he feeling right now, Tex Hayward?
I don't know, Jim. There's obviously something wrong with him. He's taken off his shoes and one of his socks, and actually, I think he's crying.
Boy.
Is this hit a little too close to home for you?
Happy week between. Happy Christmas, post-Christmas, pre-New Year.
We are putting this into the vault just a few days after Christmas 2023.
And what time of year is Kwanzaa this year?
Isn't Kwanzaa, I think Kwanzaa is always the 7 days after Christmas. Is that right?
Okay, so happy Kwanzaa. We're starting it right as we speak.
That's right.
Here, right? And what about Hanukkah this year?
Hanukkah's earlier this year, I think. Hanukkah may have ended.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Hanukkah's long past. Now, as we record this, of course, it's all in our future. But, yeah, Hanukkah's the first 2 weeks of December.
And it's all in your
distant
past.
Second week of December.
But it's important for you to know, when you listen to a podcast from thousands of years ago, whether or not it's Hanukkah or not.
That's right.
You have to understand, are these people possibly playing with a dreidel? Hard to say.
Yeah. Well, no, we're not. And if we were, we wouldn't be doing it now because it would be October where we are.
And it would be distracting during the show. Yep. Even if we were like huge dreidel buffs, I don't know if we'd be spinning it while we're trying to podcast.
But yeah, this is a time of year, I think, when we all look back. You look back at the past year and you look back at your life and
Scrooge does. You
mourn all your missed chances.
But it's also a time of renewal. Like
a time of renewal.
Scrooge gets a second chance and, you know, even today we make New Year's resolutions.
Scrooge gets a second chance.
Why is he called Scrooge? Marriage.
The thing about you, Ken, is that you don't look back in anger. Is that right? You're not. You don't look back at life and think, "Oh boy, a drag."
Well, you can't look back in anger when really everything has always kind of infuriatingly gone your way.
Yeah, boy.
So I can look back in shame at like some stupid thing I said at a party 7 years ago that I still think about twice a week.
Right.
But I don't have a lot of resentment.
You feel that you basically like achieved at the level you hoped to, maybe well surpassing.
I would say vastly more.
Can you imagine, listener, what that must feel like? I did pretty good given what I was handed.
Well, I mean, you just feel baffled by it, honestly.
Yeah.
I would say, I mean, maybe there's some people, probably Los Angeles is full of people who are like, not only am I being vastly over rewarded for my level of talent or whatever, but
I have never met a person in Los Angeles that thought or said that,
but it's not enough.
Yeah. That's, I think most people there really feel like they deserve every accolade.
Yes, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah. Yeah.
But to me, it's very baffling, especially because my particular trajectory is so, unprecedented.
Yeah. Uniquely, you know? Thin line. No one came before and no one could ever follow.
Be such a weird quiz kid as a kid that later you luck into doing it on national TV for basically the rest of your life.
Yeah. Is that a blessing or a curse? It seems like you really like it, so seems like a blessing.
Yeah, I mean, it probably doesn't say a lot for me that the same thing that I was into at 7 years old, like reading the Guinness Book of World Records and just marveling at how big the world's biggest lasagna ever baked was,
that is a marvel.
That still is a huge part of my life. Like, maybe I should have grown and progressed a little more.
Well, this is the thing about being a child prodigy.
Which I was not, by the way.
Right. But I think we have, there's something in the way we look at successful children, smart children, that's really different from the way we think of children and treat children in the main. For the most part, we understand that a child is not a grown-up and does not have the powers of a grown-up and most parents would agree children are allowed to make mistakes, you know, that children are unfinished. And
kind of a different species, honestly.
Yeah.
Like we have the illusion of continuity of remembering our own childhoods and thinking, yeah, that was still me. But that you did crazy stuff because it was kind of a different mind and a different soul.
What's your earliest memory?
I feel like I have memories of... I can narrow down to my dad being in law school. So it's got to be I'm about 2.5. I'm pretty young in my first memories.
Yeah, I have memories that are pretty young too.
Being, you know, like maybe going to the park with my brother in a stroller. So he's still a baby and eating bologna sandwiches Christmas morning. Not together. No bologna sandwiches on Christmas morning. But
well, you just said eating bologna sandwiches on Christmas morning.
Eating bologna sandwich. Memories including... eating bologna sandwiches, comma, Christmas morning, comma. Right.
I was going to say it. That sure.
I realized when it came out
you were trying to disavow a thing that you had just said. Like, I didn't just say what I just said.
I just want you to know that never happened.
That was a thing in our culture. No, it wasn't. I think especially when we were younger, in eras past, no one had any expectations of kids being... good at anything or capable of anything. I mean, kids were forced into labor, not because they were good at labor, but because they were cheap and had small hands.
Yeah, small hands. Right? Can you reach into that coal seam?
Yeah, get into that sewing machine that's operating and try not to get your finger cut off.
Unlike the old 32-year-old men, you can still breathe down in the mines.
Yeah, and that so I think that's a crucial thing, right? We do not. There are very few things where you say a child will be better at this than a grown up, except in instances where they have to either get into a small hole, or nowadays, if it involves computers in any way. Exactly. Hey, child, come over here and teach me how to use this machine.
Just the other day, I was loudly complaining to my kids at this inexplicable thing my phone was doing where my Apple Wallet would put up my membership card to the zoo.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, it does so on geolocation, and I live close enough to the zoo that my home screen for my phone was always the zoo membership. And I was like, I've looked into this, and there is no way around it.
Really?
And my kid was like, let me see that. And 20 seconds later, he was like... yeah, this menu says turn off geolocation. Why didn't you do that? And I was like, what is that screen? Where are you?
How did you get here?
Literally some screen neither of us had seen before. I feel like I'm, you know, I have a computer degree.
Yeah.
It took him 15 seconds to make his way to that screen.
My daughter does not even have a phone. And this happens all the time. Where I'm like, why is it doing this? And she says, hand it to me. And sees the invisible thing that says, would you like to turn this off? Yeah. There is a thing. It's just invisible unless you are 12 years old.
Wouldn't it be funny if there actually were like pre-industrial revolution variants of this? Like the kids were actually like if, you know,
somebody... Oh, you don't know how to make mead. Step away. Let me make this mead.
I don't know what it would be. I guess it could be early industrial revolution. The kid who's like, who looks at the steam engine for 1 second and is like, no. You've got these belts on backwards.
Well, and so that would imply a kind of prodigiousness, right? A sort of
special knowledge.
Yeah, like an
But
ability.
You're right, all kids have the phone thing.
It's weird, right? There is the ability to see into a black box and imagine what's happening in there. That is a kind of mental acuity. And the digital native thing where you just understand...
Menus are like rooms and hallways to them,
yeah,
I guess.
Intuitively, the architecture of the internet is, or the way things work, because we're always saying, it should do this.
Yeah.
And we're frustrated by the fact that it doesn't do what it should. And they all seem to be much... they approach it differently. Like, well, it does do that. It just does it over here.
Yeah.
Under the profiles tab. And you're like, what the? I've never even been to the profiles tab. I don't even know what that does.
We're imagining a perfect world where there is no profiles tab.
Yeah.
You know, we're the dreamers.
That's right. We're still the dreamers.
We're the Bobby Kennedys. And they're in the mines being like, no, this is the world as it is. There is a profiles tab. And for some reason, this is where the other options menu is.
But, you know, we've talked on the show quite a bit about the, you know, the curse of being gifted.
Because we did a show once about a particular child prodigy. Do you remember this?
Yeah.
Winifred Sackville Stoner. And it was just kind of she had a stage mom, so she became a vaudeville act, basically. But I'm sure on that show we talked a little bit about growing up with the, whatever that is that hangs over you when people are like, you know, your child is clearly very capable.
And we live in a time, I think we live now in the fallout of a time when we knew enough about psychology to know that there were special people, but didn't have the power to know what to do. To be able to differentiate different kinds of special, and in particular to know what was best to do when you encountered someone that had special abilities. And certainly mid-century Western world really wanted special children to be a kind of like powerful resource, to be able to take a child with an acuity and turn that child into a world-altering kind of lever.
Well, it coincides with and flatters every parent's secret belief that their child is uniquely special in some way.
And that, I think, is a modern... I do not think that the parents of the 19th century all believed that their children were like... beautiful, brilliant little flower.
Well, we've talked about this. The fact that, you know, half of them were dying of dysentery and then the new sibling would get the name of the other one who just died. I mean, it's a different way. It's a harder world to raise kids.
A harder world. And I think we see a lot, and we've talked about this on the show too, that the problem now is that, yeah, there are enough different gifted programs and enough ways that loud, squeaky parents can get their children promoted into programs because it's all seen as part of the meritocracy, part of the false meritocracy that we believe undergirds our world.
Are you following the Seattle area drama on this right now?
No.
I think basically the Seattle Public Schools is getting rid of its, whatever they call their gifted and talented, I think highly capable. They're getting rid of their highly capable track.
Right.
And what they're saying is, this is good. This will now be administered by local schools, however they want to do that. And what it really means is no resources or emphasis will be thrown that way at all.
And is it because it's an equity issue for people?
I think it is a little unfashionable, you know, that the emphasis is actually on how do we get everybody up to grade level standards, whereas before, I think there was quite a bit of thought that, you know, like, this is the tiny amount of money that actually produces the highest achieving kids. You know, the stakes are the highest for these kids. Whereas now, I think there's quite a bit of thought the other way, which is these kids are going to be fine. They've already got the resources at home or whatever. The problem's on the other side of the bell curve.
Yeah, what to do with public money in a world in which the kid that's going to probably test the best is also the one that has a lot of books at home. And
they will be fine anyway for 8 different reasons.
Right. But it also is a kind of changing mentality about what adulthood is and what we're, I mean, in a way, as we have gone from a manufacturing and industrial economy to being like an entertainment and service economy, what do we need from adults? And when we look at a child in school, what are the skills that we're going to really celebrate? It used to be, and traditionally, kind of a lot of the prodigies that we see singled out as children are math and science prodigies.
Probably that's just the biggest variance between what a highly capable kid can achieve and what the run-of-the-mill kid can achieve. That's where the difference is most stark, I assume.
Well, and also measurable.
Right.
It's very hard to say this 5-year-old who is babbling is a poet and that 5-year-old that's babbling is a ding-dong, because great poetry and incomprehensible babble really require a studied ear to differentiate, whereas differential equations have a right and wrong answer.
And there's some level of societal chauvinism as well, where I think, you know, if as a culture, we kind of assume on some level, well, science is what is going to create the American century.
Science!
Then, of course, you're going to be looking for the kids who are doing science!
Science!
And the kids who are very good at putting a sentence together, you're not thinking, boy, like, what? How do we get this kid into Dartmouth?
Well, and in the arts, music prodigies are the ones that we really see and single out, the pianists and the violinists. It's much rarer that you see a child prodigy that's a visual artist.
That's true.
Right.
And it must be size of, I think that's size of the gap, like, right? Because there are just for whatever reason, 4-year-olds who can compose and perform like Mozart, and there are maybe not 4-year-old painters?
Well, I think there are. It's just that if you had a 4-year-old paint a Basquiat and hung it next to a Basquiat, would, you know, how many people would go, the child's a genius? And how many would say, oh, it's just that the kid is splattering paint and cutting out pictures from magazines.
But I mean, you can do that by picking a contemporary artist. But if you were to say, like, have you ever, you know, I've heard a four-year-old, you know, I've seen videos of 4-year-olds playing the cello, like, to my ear, indistinguishably from the best adult. And I don't see a 4-year-old painting, you know, a Van Gogh or a Rubens canvas. You know?
Right. Well, and I think the difference is that it's almost exclusively, until recently, prodigies were all in classical music, because it was a big part of this is differentiating between being a prodigy and being a genius.
Ooh, I don't even know. What's the...
Well, one way of seeing it is that prodigies are people who become incredibly proficient at a known ability at a young age.
They're just ahead.
They're way ahead in their ability to learn languages, to be able to do math and science, to do classical music, you know, but they are not reinventing the arts.
They're doing that stuff at the level of a non-genius adult, which is amazing because they're 6.
Or a really smart adult.
Yeah.
But adult. And a genius who is potentially reinventing art, you know, Picasso, as I'm constantly explaining to my daughter, knew how to paint. He didn't just go immediately into cubism. And a child that was truly reinventing the wheel, it's kind of like when you see the saints in their early years, they're hard to distinguish between someone that's insane or has epilepsy, right? I mean, it's a... true inspiration is hard to distinguish from insanity.
And do children ever have that level of that level of true inspiration?
Yes, but I don't think, but I think they often are not recognized until later. I mean, Mozart is an example of a person at a very young age who was absolutely reinventing the art form. He was not just good at playing the classical music of the generation before his, but he was, you know, prodigious and also blindingly new.
So he actually is innovating.
Right.
Even though, you know, he still spills soup down his front when he eats.
as Mozart would say.
That's not the real Mozart.
You know, like Pascal was not just solving differential equations in a way that was blowing adults' minds. Pascal was inventive and like really advancing math. So you do see...
How young? Like,
oh, I mean, he was...
He's like a teen or
something? He was yeah, he was writing his treatises in his mid-teens. And, you know, was writing exchanging letters with Fermat and, you know, was a... There are prodigies that become public intellectuals. The problem, of course, now is that in the 17th and 18th centuries, being a well-rounded intellectual without any borders between being a chemist and a biologist and even a philosopher,
yeah,
allowed for prodigies to, and of course, a lot of them were wealthy. That's how you end up, your name ends up getting written down because you have the leisure time and the space to sit around and philosophize and have microscopes and so forth. But there wasn't the kind of compartmentalization that you might see now. If a kid can learn five languages by the time they're three and can do differential equations, you're probably not going to encourage them to be a translator of poetry as much as you're going to encourage them to become a mathematician. Because there's that sense of like the practical skill, as you were saying, practical and scientific skill is what we still need in the world.
Yeah, and back then it would reflect that adults could do everything. So why wouldn't your gifted kids also be trying out all the sciences?
Yeah, and it was unclear what it was, the differentiation between alchemy and natural philosophy. You know, it wasn't so clear. Well, there weren't silos the way they are now.
Yeah.
And maybe the silos that we have now are part of what hold us back, actually.
I'm a big believer in that, but it's very easy for me to say, generalist, that's the way to be, because I'm a quiz show contestant, and there's not a lot of jobs that reward
specialization.
Exactly equal knowledge of architecture, ancient history, astronomy, and, you know, everything else the way my job does.
I think we have a lot of listeners to the Omnibus who are specialists.
Everybody has to be a specialist. It's hard to make a living without being a specialist.
But I think if there's a group of people that value the generalist, it would have to be futurelings.
Yeah.
And we can come out, you and I, as pro-generalists. We're generalist stands. In a way that maybe our culture has forgotten, or it feels even a little bit like archaic to say.
There's not a stigma, but the fact that it doesn't actually reflect professional success at all, that just means it kind of falls off the radar.
Well, but also like generalism is in itself a kind of privilege that at least right now people are very suspicious of. Well, what use is that practical knowledge? What are you doing other than sitting around reading? I mean, you know that.
Yeah, it's shuttering humanities departments, honestly.
Yeah. How can you justify $60,000 a year tuition to just sit and lean back in your chair and think deep thoughts. But of course, that's maybe, is there anything more important?
Somebody's got to do it.
And thank God you and I have these comfortable chairs. When I started to look into this show, it was because I was familiar, I've been familiar for a long time with this particular Korean prodigy who is not that much older than we are. He was born in 1962 in Seoul. His name is Kim Ung-yong.
I'm not familiar with this guy.
And he was, in some ways, the archetypical child prodigy. At 1 year old, he was already speaking in full sentences, had memorized the Korean alphabet, and had memorized a very famous text in Chinese called the Thousand Character Classic, which is a kind of poem in Chinese that uses 1,000 different characters, never repeating.
And it's like the basic characters you should know, basically?
Yeah, the basic characters. And if you can memorize this poem, you will have at least memorized the ability to see, recognize, and pronounce, although maybe not use eloquently, but you would be able to recognize these 1,000 Chinese characters, basically the foundation of a lot of Asian language. And
by 1 year old, he knew 1,000 Chinese characters.
By 1 year old.
How many did you know when you were one? How many Chinese characters? Is he ahead of you?
I think at that point, he's
little ahead of me.
He's 6 years older than me, so he would have been, well ahead of me by that point. But by the time he was 3 years old, he was able to do calculus and had written several essays in English and German and had illustrated the manuscripts himself. And his essays were collected into a volume of almost a 250-page volume.
Essays?
Essays on various topics. 3 years old. And by,
I'm interested in reading the essays. You know, because when a kid can compose a fugue or solve, you know, do matrix algebra, you kind of think of it like a trained SEAL, like, you know, this extraordinarily advanced kid has been taught the steps and can learn them in a way that normally only an adult can do, because they're, like you say, prodigiously accelerated.
Yeah.
But what does a 4 or 5 year old have to say in his essays?
And part of the problem of...
It's like Andy Rooney. Did you ever notice when mom gives you the banana milk and you wanted the strawberry milk?
Basically, the Seinfeld writers were just plumbing his essays for scripts. Like, what's the deal with shower curtains?
I kind of want to read his essays.
Part of the problem of telling this story is that we're talking about early 60s and mid 60s South Korea. And the way that it wasn't a media culture like we live in now.
Right.
The stories about this boy are being translated through, a lack of access to him directly. There's not paparazzi writing big stories about him. There's a lot of stuff in this story that kind of either can't be confirmed or has been debunked.
And by the way, don't imagine 1960s era Korea as some kind of Asian tiger economy like post-war Japan. I mean, it was like a decade since the Korean War had ended.
Yeah.
And it was still very much an agrarian economy.
Yeah. And the, you know, the West would not, had not necessarily focused its attention on Korea and all of the human interest stories that were pouring out of suburban Seoul.
So he would not have been written up in Western papers, even though he was doing remarkable work?
He was. I mean, Kim Ung-yong's father was a physics professor. His mother was a teacher. Like, they were, they recognized his abilities. By the age of 4, he was studying physics at Hanyang U. He was a cause celeb, or a celebrity, but like a paragraph long story. Like, it there wasn't the kind of of fascination with this.
Nobody's writing long profiles of him.
Yeah, no one's
putting
really
him on the Steve Allen show.
Sitting, I mean, he did appear on Japanese television.
Oh yeah.
At the age of 5, and they at by the time he was 5, he'd been assessed at having an over 200 IQ. At the time, the highest IQ ever recorded.
He's the smartest person in the world.
The smartest person in the world. He spoke Korean, English, French, German, and Japanese by the age of 5. And on Japanese television, on a television show, and it's astonishing footage to watch. He's a little boy, a little 5-year-old little boy. And they've got differential equations, integral calculus up on the blackboard, and he's just looking at it and working it out and solving problems in a way that's astonishing. I mean, really, like the kind of thing you would watch in a Hollywood picture and just go, you know, and inspiring the sort of awe that you almost can't help but feel like what greatness is going to come out of this kid. If he can do this at 5, you can't help but believe that that has to be an exponential power.
Because you think of it as a multiplier, like, boy, he's doing work, you know, 1,000 times more complex than his peers. Imagine in 20 years when he's still doing work 1,000 times more complex than his fellow grad students.
Yeah.
And I assume that's actually not how intelligence and talent work.
Well, and think about that, because being able to do those equations on a blackboard on Japanese television certainly exceeds my ability.
And now,
presumably yours.
I could do very simple differential equations for a couple semesters, and then I was about done with calculus.
So it isn't just, wow, this is amazing that a 5-year-old can do this. It would be amazing. I mean, it wouldn't maybe get you on television, but it'd be pretty impressive if you and I gathered all of our friends together and had a calculus on a blackboard. The number of people that could probably work through it between us. Do you know how many of our friends, mutual friends, could do differential equations?
It's really got to be somebody we know who works in the sciences, because you know, nobody who doesn't
keeps that stuff around.
To me, I still have some kind of trained seal problem where I watch this kid and I think, obviously he's an exceptional talent and he's one end of that curve, but to what degree did he just have academic parents who realized the extraordinary plasticity of the young mind? Like, with what percentage of the kids in this neighborhood could you get, not results to that degree, but some kind of astonishing results if you put them through a, hey, let's learn 5 languages before you're 2 kind of a boot camp? I mean, because kids do have amazingly plastic intelligence.
So the parents of true prodigies report, it's almost a shared trauma they have, because their experience is of this rare child that is so hungry.
You're struggling to keep up.
Desperately trying to keep this child fed.
Wow.
With stuff that's way over your head and trying to understand and interact with a kid that's yours, but can speak 6 languages that they taught themselves from a book of ancient Chinese poems that somehow, I mean, if I gave my daughter a book of ancient Chinese poems, she and I would know right now the same number of Chinese characters, which is 0, because it didn't matter, you know. And I think every parent who craves a gifted child, either because it reinforces their own identity or they want their kid to have every advantage, you know, they're filling their kids' bassinets with Mozart.
Baby Mozart and baby Beethoven. And
most kids are interested in what they're interested in.
Smearing poop on the walls.
That's right. They're dolls and some stories about rabbits. To have a kid that by the age of 5 is fluent in 5 languages sounds like it's very hard for the parents and a constant struggle, right? The kid has to be just kind of otherworldly to deal with.
I was kind of a sponge where, like, I think my parents were just bewildered by, like, why does he just want to keep, you know, reading about state capitals? And why does he keep want to reading about presidents and Oscar winners? And because I think I was the same way. And I can't even articulate what that drive was, but it was like, boy, this really gets my brain humming for whatever reason.
Yeah.
More of this, more of everything. I don't know why.
And I think I realized that if I could make grown-ups laugh, I would get them off my case.
Yeah.
So because I also just wanted to sit and read the encyclopedia, but I knew I wasn't performing the right kind of little chain of tasks that made everybody clap and give me more candy. But if I could make them laugh, they gave me some space. And, you know, and my mom was a depressed, middle-aged single mom. Keeping her laughing was where I put some of my energy. And as I got older, I realized that I could mask a whole secret life if I just kept everybody bouncing along, you know, with a combination of, like, what seemed like sarcasm above my years, right? Like, humor is a thing that it's sort of like math. You can make adults feel like, wow, he's really a prodigy, but you've just decoded a kind of
right.
sophisticated irony.
You've kind of intuited a voice from yeah. hearing other people use it. You couldn't articulate what the rules are, but now you can.
Yeah.
Now you're like generative AI and you can apply them to social situations.
And to be an 8-year-old with an ironic take seems, it points at a deeper intelligence that, like you're saying, you might just be mimicking Catskill comedians that you're watching on late night TV, but at least you get the rhythm and the patter whether or not, and you recognize that it looks wise to grown-ups, even though you, yes. you don't
There's
know.
There's the immediate ego boost of being entertaining. Yeah. Whereas if you actually, you know, I would always be the adult pleaser trying to draw the nicer picture or whatever, or, you know, get the better grade that my parents would applaud. But that's not as direct as, you know, making a room of people laugh or.
Yeah. And you get you figure out, like, if in a certain situation with the right trigger words, if you walk into the middle of a group of adults and go, Henry Kissinger, am I right? They're all going to fall down and you have no idea what you're saying. Differential equations are different though. They're measurable. You could do a double blind where it's a 5-year-old on one side and a 25-year-old on the other. It's just a question of whether you solved the equation.
Who's right and who's first?
But what happened to Kim Eun-young is, in trying to find a place for this kind of genius, in the mid-60s,
in Seoul, Korea.
In Seoul, Korea.
You know, which would be the equivalent of, you know, raising a kid in, you know, like something like Nigeria or Paraguay today.
Uh-huh. Because he was assessed, and this was the era where IQ tests right. and psychology, this was
all.
Peak era. He was the smartest person in the world, although not for long.
Oh.
He was unthroned.
By a different kid.
By no less a kid than Marilyn Vosavant.
Oh, hey.
Your gal pal.
I forgot, we must have talked about her. Oh, we did a whole show about her.
Yeah.
Boy, we've done two prodigies.
I know. The list.
But she's not failed. She writes an advice column.
She did write an advice column, although a lot of people had higher expectations of Marilyn Vosavant.
Yeah.
And she, I think, was, you know, if you read her biography, like the most celebrated era of her life was when people were arguing with her about whether or not about the Monty Hall problem.
Oh, yeah.
Whether
yeah.
or not you should change the Doors.
Probability yeah. exercises.
And it was like 10 weeks on the New York Times editorial page. She's wrong. She's right. Women don't know math. And, you know, she had a 228 IQ or something.
And she's
like that.
Finally getting that attention.
Yeah.
That probably was a lot of what powered her through her early gifts.
But what she says, if you read kind of her accounts of her life, you know, she wanted what most people want, which is to have a normal, engaging, well-rounded life. She didn't see herself as someone who was going to use that intelligence to reinvent the. What would Marilyn Vos Savant reinvent? I mean, her husband reinvented the heart.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
She was married to Jarvik, right?
Yeah.
Well, she could reinvent the communication satellite.
Oh, communication satellite.
Or the spleen.
No, Elon Musk is doing that for us. Our modern well,
only
genius.
Because Marilyn Vos Savant didn't get there first.
There you go. But Kim Eun-young gets recruited by mid-60s NASA.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, who... you know, this is the era when pre-big computers.
How early is this? Are they recruiting an 11-year-old, or is he graduated with multiple degrees and they're like, come to the West?
No, he's not in multiple degree land, although there are a lot of different stories. This is the problem. There are a lot of different stories about like, oh, and then he went to University of Colorado and was studying nuclear physics. And then someone else says, well, how is that possible? Because he was at 8 years old still living with his parents, and they said this in this interview. Well, they said that in another
interview.
So
there's some mythology about his academic achievements?
Partly it's mythology, and partly it just feels like bad media garbage. Yeah. You know, like somebody did an interview and it was taken as read.
Because it was the only thing written about this person, and it turns out it was just some guy spending 45 minutes of his day putting this thing together. And it's 100% of what we know about this kid from that time.
Yeah, but then 15 years later or 30 years later, somebody comes along and writes a piece debunking it. The thing about Kim Eun-young is that he's still alive. He's 61 years old.
He's only 61.
Yeah, you could go and ask him right now to confirm or deny.
Should we do it?
Maybe we should. I mean, you speak Korean.
We never get a guest on the show.
He speaks German, Japanese,
French. Yeah, my Korean is terrible, but like maybe our Portuguese is the same level.
But so he worked for NASA on string theory and doing research for them, and he had exactly the kind of life you sort of would expect a super genius kid from this time period would have, which is no social life, no social skills, just grinding away at math problems, and all the adults in his life going like, yeah, good.
He literally became a rocket scientist.
Yeah, like, do it.
That was
it.
The definition of intellectual success.
Here's another problem. Can you solve this one? And then, you know, you've got some eight-year-old kid churning away. And by all accounts, probably pretty miserable.
Yeah, that's the stereotype, that these kids are not, that's not what they want.
Because what do you do with someone who's that smart but is also a kid and just wants to do kid things and hard enough for you and me to interact with other kids who did not understand, did not care about the Kansas-Nebraska Act. I mean, I watch the challenge my daughter is having right now, just finding normal kids that enjoy the same fairly normal things she likes to do.
If she was
a challenge,
right?
Right. Just like, hey, how do you feel about? I mean, can you even handle me just being my normal self without needing special music or, you know, to have to take a break every hour or so to solve some calculus? Just to keep my mind.
I think I have observed certainly one and maybe both of my kids. The digital world has made it so easy for them to find people who share even their weirdest. You know, no matter how obscure the anime, it's not hard to find 10,000 Americans who want to talk to you about it today.
Right.
That they kind of find that real life falls short. You know, the internet's seductively easy to find people talking about whatever their latest fascination is. Why don't the people in my life want to talk about that?
Well, and I think one of the things we are confronting as a culture now about the internet is that the internet thrives on dividing us into tiny little silos. The more obscure the little anime corner, the better.
Yeah.
Because there's only 15 of you in the whole world, and here you've found yourselves, and while you're here, let us advertise to you.
What if all those kids just thought Ted Lasso was fine? Yeah. That's the correct attitude to have toward a TV series.
I mean, if I think about the kids that I was friends with in grade school, they weren't like me at all. The kids across the street were really into baseball cards. I couldn't have cared less.
I was briefly surprised when one of the athletic kids in my class suddenly was into Tintin comics, because I was like, oh, I have some of these. We can talk about Tintin.
Yeah.
But I certainly didn't expect it.
No, right. I mean, I had a friend named Tony who loved Batman. I didn't care about Batman. My friends Thomas and Peter loved taking apart old radios and putting them back together with soldering irons. And I didn't care about that either. Like, none of my friends had interests anything like mine. What I wanted to do was set things on fire and watch them burn. And if I could make them explode, even better.
And until their parents learned about that, they were allowed to hang out with you.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't know when I stopped trying to burn everything that I came in contact with, but you wouldn't call that a special power.
It's a nice kind of a specialization, this village where we kind of all assume that everybody has little odd hobbies that we're willing to hear about for a short period of time, and that just that makes the community beautiful. It has all these resources.
But I wouldn't have identified any of those things as reasons to or to not hang out with the kids in my neighborhood. And I don't think anybody would have looked at me and said, like, oh, the burner kid, we've got some stuff that needs to get burned.
But that's unusual. Everybody, I mean, even generations older than you, I think, would have been like, ah, we're going to define ourselves with punk, or we're going to define ourselves with jazz, or sports.
Except in my dad's era, every kid played sports, according to him. Now, he loved sports, but if you were an 8-year-old boy in 1930,
what did they do?
They're playing stickball out in the street. I mean, what else is there for a kid to do? Except for the Poindexter, who was playing the violin.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Even the kids back then that weren't good at sports still were out playing stickball.
Yeah, I mean, I think so.
It mattered less if you were bad?
Yeah, or just there wasn't another concept.
What else would you do together?
And maybe it's kids like Kim Um-young who were at the forefront of this idea that, like, oh, these are, you know, even if he was as old as my dad, his ability to do differential calculus would never have either been discovered or wouldn't have occurred to anybody.
Well, the wouldn't have been discovered thing is huge. I mean, like, it just, when you see this kid with the outlier IQ, you just think, well, there were hundreds of thousands more of him, but because of their milieu, we'll never know.
Well, and it's part of the equity question, right? Which is, like, are there kids that could be doing differential equations at the age of 4, but because they live in a neighborhood where there are no resources and their parents don't read, are they lost? And that is predicated on a still, I think, very strong belief we have that finding the kid that can do that is important to us as a culture, because those kids are going to save us, or those kids are they're the future in some way, right? They're the geniuses are the ones that we need to single out.
But this is the unfashionable great man theory of, you know, Walter Isaacson's books, where, you know, the culture will only get remade as long as there is an Einstein or a Steve Jobs to pull us, to drag us into the future.
Right.
And, I mean, it's all kind of coming apart for poor Walter Isaacson writing books about Elon Musk and having to pretend that this guy is the...
I know.
Like, the boy, without him, what would we do? We wouldn't have our electric cars.
And that's part of what is so gross about this, is that we're living in an era where geniuses are all around us, and all of their disruptions, it turns out, are not that smart. You know, my mom asked me the other day. I've been having some dental meetings lately with a new bunch of dentists.
You're taking meetings.
Taking some meetings with dentists. And my mom said, you know, back in 1970, I had the following procedure. And I realized that in 2012, if I had had that procedure that she had in 1970, I would have been relieved of a tremendous amount of pain, suffering, and expense that I've endured over the last decade. But by 2013, that procedure, that 1970 procedure, was seen as archaic. it had been improved upon by a dozen generations of new dental best practices.
Did those practices later get discredited?
No, what happened was they were overcomplicating a simple thing.
Oh, I see.
That in order to advance the practice of dentistry, they were using new technologies, new materials, better and better outcomes. But what they weren't thinking was that, well, actually, we already had a way to do this that was great. And all these new practices involve all this new technology, all this new expense, all these new, you have to do this before you do that, you have to do this before you do that.
And the advantages don't make up for the complexity.
They don't at all. And what could, and, you know, a steel bolt into a, you know, into a root would hold a tooth, in my mom's case, for 60 years. And taking that tooth out and replacing it with a titanium implant that would require a bone graft. I mean, all this is much better science if you're trying to make a perfect human. But it's, in my case, has been really bad in terms of just like, I'm a regular guy who just wants to eat an apple. Can we do the cheapest version of that?
They don't make them like they used to.
Get me out the door. So, I mean, I follow a hilarious Instagram account that's just like, are tech bros reinventing?
Yeah, you often again? Will see somebody post something and it'll be like, dude, that's the city bus.
Yeah, you're just talking about the bus.
You're talking about the bus. We have that.
Oh no, we're gonna break, you know, break it all.
No, that's a coffee shop. We have that.
And so that's the, you know, that's kind of where we are technologically. And so what happened was once I decided I was going to dive into Kim Eun-young, I said there's got to be a lot of instances of this kind of child, a super smart child who is thrust into these environments where, in a way, it seems like we're enthusiastically supporting this genius, otherworldly kid by putting them in places where their intelligence is challenged and put to great use. But in fact, they are children that get because of a curiosity of the mind, put into kind of inhumane circumstances where they don't, not only do they not interact with other kids, they don't learn any social skills.
They don't get a childhood.
No.
Right. And it's maybe similar to the trauma you later see child actors report of being thrust into situations they weren't ready for.
And we do need child actors because in the sense that when we tell stories, we do need there to be kids.
No, they should all be CG now.
That look deeply into Bruce Willis's eyes and go, I see dead people. I'm making a lot of Sixth Sense references.
Yeah,
lately.
Did you just see a Sixth Sense?
I did.
You got some deep cuts here.
I said to my daughter right around Halloween, I said, you know, we should watch a scary movie. And she says, I don't like scary movies. I said, I don't either. None of us like scary movies, but it's Halloween. And then I thought, you know what a good scary movie is that's not that scary is The Sixth Sense, because it's no jump scares. It's not, I mean, there's a couple. And what I forgot was that psychological terror is just as terrible.
Maybe worse for kids.
So we're
kids
sitting.
Kids might giggle at a cat jumping out of a washing machine, but they will see a kid with a balloon under a bed forever.
Yeah. And she's now, you know, several days on just looking at me with these accusatory eyes like, you monster. Made me watch this movie about dead people.
Hey, kids have to learn about ghosts sometime.
That's right. That's right.
You got to be ready for a world full of ghosts.
Yeah. How would we know if you saw dead people or not unless we watched the movie?
They don't know they're dead.
The problem with these child prodigies is that prodigious intelligence in math does not grow exponentially forever.
That's my assumption, that they're advanced. But then the other smarties in their field catch up. They just had a brain, some kind of unusual brain structure that gave them a head start.
Yeah. When you're a 21-year-old at MIT, the number of people around you who can do differential equations is pretty high. And some of them, although maybe they weren't geniuses at 5 years old, are just as smart as you.
Well, in a very small way, I remember hitting the moment when I could no longer count on whatever my accelerated childhood was. And suddenly I was not the best in my class at math, and suddenly everybody else can write cleaner code than I can in my computer science classes. And there were still areas where I was like, oh yeah, I still feel like all the reading I did means I can put a sentence together better than some of these kids. But in almost all my other math and science classes, I quickly realized that I was not actually ready for the real world. And in fact, I'd been coasting.
Well, I mean, I still will read the room, including on this podcast, and go, huh, Henry Kissinger, am I right? And then I go, I don't know. I hope that was funny. I don't know what that, I'm not sure what that reference was to, but it's worked for me my whole life.
But it's got to be hard for these kids who like kind of thought that they would always have this head start.
Well, it is. And it often ends, you know, in some ways, the best case scenarios are the ones where kids just sort of evolve into obscurity. And in a lot of cases, what they're best at is teaching. They're really good at this subject matter, and they are kind of, I mean, they had a childhood where maybe they didn't have all the great experiences of being a young person. And so becoming teachers keeps, you know, their skills are very useful, and they can kind of stay in a protected environment at a university.
It's funny because they were the kids that didn't need that kind of teacher, but maybe that helps.
Yeah.
You know, and certainly they'd have a sense of mission about it. Like, you know, how do I get other young minds to have the same passion I did?
Yeah. And they often really love the obscurity. They're glad to finally have found a place where they can be that.
Drab academia.
But they're just a nobody. The problem is that in our culture, it's including this show, it's very, I mean, this episode, it's almost irresistible for us to look at these cases and want to go back and say, what happened to?
Where are they now?
Whatever happened to this super genius kid that could do all these things? And whether they were a brilliant cellist or a chess prodigy like Bobby Fischer or Stevie Wonder, or Ted Kaczynski, like there's always a lot of the time, the prodigy story for every Stevie Wonder, where you go, he was a genius as a kid and he reinvented music.
Stayed, yeah, for pretty much a decade.
Oh, longer, right? I mean, Stevie Wonder like really changed the world.
But I'm just saying, for like those four records in the 70s.
Well, late 60s, think about the records he wrote and made. Yeah, I mean,
right. Like he's ahead of, he's ahead of everybody else in his field.
Yeah.
As an adult for decades.
Well, and inarguably altered the course of popular music. Whereas Ted Kaczynski,
same with Kaczynski, he's bombing at a, he's still 10 years ahead of grade level.
That's right.
Nobody else is blowing stuff up like he is.
So it often is part of the origin story of real villains. Or real victims.
Are you talking about in fiction or in real life?
In real life.
Because it's a fictional trope too, you know, Lex Luthor and all these people.
If the guy that invented RSS, Aaron Schwartz, became a hacker and then was...
He was one of these teenage...
Yeah, who was prosecuted by the government and committed suicide at a young age as a result of, you know, being like,
I remember this story
now. One of these burned brightly and didn't live long enough to see his narrative arc turn all the way around. There's a woman named Sufia Yusuf who was a child prodigy who went to Oxford, and it turned out was the child of an abusive father. And although she's at Oxford being really celebrated as like a young genius prodigy, ended up leaving Oxford, and they found her working as a waitress in a diner, refused to return to her parents. And so she's in one of these sort of movie prodigy, you almost feel like Angelina Jolie is playing her in some movie where half the time she's at Oxford and she's a brilliant 13-year-old, and the other half of the time she's...
We're cutting back and forth to the...
Yeah. And eventually she was, like, this is the thing about the English press, discovered by the Daily Mail working as a sex worker while still kind of pursuing advanced degrees at Oxford in various hard subjects that I don't myself know.
So complex, I cannot even name them.
I could not even do...
I would need a different degree just to name the things she got her degree in.
So wow. The number of child prodigies that end up going on in the sciences to actually change the course of that of those practices, rather than go into the sciences and find a comfortable home and become kind of not middling mathematicians and scientists, but just like competent, useful, but not Mozart's. It casts a pretty bright light on the idea of a prodigy and what their role in our lives should be. What do we do with them? We can't think outside of the idea of them being like a resource to exploit, and
and a savior, right?
Yeah, with the idea that they are here to guide. It's a great man philosophy. They're the ones that are going to show us the way.
But you would feel like you were letting them down if your 5-year-old could do differential equations, and you were like, yeah, but do you really want to?
But Pokemon.
Do you want to do a harder one? Like, what if we went to the park? I mean.
But I noticed with my own kid at 12 that I have to practice a lot of giving her the space to be learning and saying, well, you don't have to perform at an adult level, either intellectually or socially, and particularly socially, right? That seems like the more important of the two realms. Whether or not you can do this assignment is small potatoes compared to whether or not you can make friends and keep friends and be part of a community. And learning as a parent to say, like, this is awkward. You're going to feel awkward in this situation. I feel awkward on your behalf, but don't worry. One day this will all come together in a sensible manner. But to forget all of that because she could do math.
Yeah, I wonder if you just subconsciously start treating the kid as a colleague.
You almost can't help it, yeah. Right? Because if they're smarter than you at math, then surely they also know the great secrets. And the kid is a performer, and the kid knows how to make a Henry Kissinger joke.
And on some level, the kid may not be great at taking criticism, you know? The kid who has always been used to being one step ahead of adults is not going to like when you give them rules, when you give them life advice, when you tell them they're not treating others well. I mean...
What I didn't know as a kid was that making that Henry Kissinger joke meant that a half hour later, some drunk Rotarian was going to sidle up next to me and go like, God, my wife... Let me tell you, she never listens. And because he thought
you're a peer.
He could talk to me because I'd made him laugh. And I think that's probably true for a lot of these prodigies too. Not that drunks are trying to talk to them about their marital difficulties, but worse in a way, like that they're expected to make decisions about whether or not they want to work at NASA, or the assumption is that they do.
Well, if your average prodigy is just going to maybe at some point level out at the top of their field and they just got there too quickly, what do you do differently? Like, how do you raise them differently? Do you just say, no, let's continue to do this at grade level, you know, and then you'll get as good at this stuff as everybody else. You just won't be as good between the ages of 6 and 17, and who cares?
Yeah, I wonder. I mean, that's what I don't know if we can know. If you put an 8-year-old Kim Eun-young in a room with a bunch of calculus textbooks, or a bicycle. Well, first of all, putting him in a room with a bicycle would be mean.
Yes.
But gave him a bicycle and a park or a bunch of calculus books. Like
he could get the books in a park, too. Let's do the whole thing in a park.
Okay. We're in a park. There's a stack of books. It's a sunny day or a bicycle. You know, to what degree we can't go back to 1968 Seoul and know, but it's happening all around us all the time.
And the kids in these stories, as you say, are often just so enthusiastic for the subject of their own excellence, you know, that you don't have to be a violin taskmaster to get the kid that is really very self-driven about the thing that they know they're being told they're good at.
Yeah.
Unsurprisingly. Like you might take active dissuading to be like, No. We love that you're good at the violin, but it's too much of your life right now. Like maybe just an hour a day.
If you think about,
and the kid might be unhappy to hear that.
If you think about how good you and I were at going through the Sears catalog and picking out all of the Sears catalog.
The pages with the bras on them. That's the only thing I ever did the Sears catalog.
You could have called me a genius at a lot of things in 1976 that ended up not really playing a big profound role in my life. In the case of Kim Eun-young, he ended up being a professor, an assistant professor for a long time, and then in 2014 at Shinhan U, he became a full professor he's got multiple degrees in civil engineering, and he by all accounts is like extremely happy and contented person, but is routinely the subject of magazine articles about being a failed prodigy. What happened? What a loss that he only ended up a math professor.
Can you imagine
when
that
he
life?
Could have been so much more, like, for instance, an inventor of something, right?
Like, why didn't you invent the internet, found a company?
Yeah, why aren't we walking on Mars now?
Yeah, exactly.
Because
get
of
us
you.
To Mars.
And so many of the great prodigies are subjected to this what happened to you narrative when, in fact, nothing happened to them. They're living their best lives.
And that concludes Prodigies, Failed. I guess we should have put failed in quotation marks.
We still can.
In your mind.
In your mind.
We did air quotes.
Listener, we were mocking it the whole time.
Entry 990.LK0240, certificate number 50285, in the omnibus. Now, whether you consider yourself a genius or a disappointment. I assume all of our listeners are like woebegone, above average, gifted children.
And probably all feel like disappointments.
Yeah, none of you got us to Mars.
I mean, my mom has said that she got out of Ohio in the 1950s. She got out of Van Wert and she went to the University of Ohio. I'm sorry. She got out of Van Wert and she went to Ohio State.
The Ohio State.
Let me not make that mistake. And just in going to Ohio State, she so exceeded the expectations of anyone in her town,
right,
that expected her to just, you know, marry a farmer.
She was a prodigy.
Well, she has said from that moment forward, everything in her life feels like a gift because the expectations for her were so low that every day she wakes up, she has exceeded anything you could have predicted about her.
What does that imply about parenting? You should constantly be telling your kids,
look, kid, you're not going to amount to anything. And then they feel incredible their whole lives. And she said, you know, in comparison to you, who we spent your whole childhood telling you about all the wonderful worlds you'd see, everything has ever since then seemed
kind
of a drag.
I never had a top 40 record.
And that's that's one of the problems of our era. And I think there's enough literature now saying, congratulate your kids on, or a conventional wisdom saying, congratulate your kids on their accomplishments, not on their abilities.
Yeah.
And that seems to work-ish, except that our whole culture is baked into this
Yeah, they're not going to buy it. Even if you're praising them constantly for effort.
Hey, you did a good job there.
I think they can tell.
Yeah, they're like, yeah, but am I a genius or not?
That's not how capitalism
works.
Mom,
dad, look at me. Am I a genius? I mean, you know, you have a kid that's in this, I'm just going to be a YouTube star world of the modern economy where it's like, what job do you want to do? Oh, I don't know. Be famous? I'm going to play video games and other people are going to pay to watch me play them. I mean, what's Dylan's current plan?
High school teacher.
No kidding. Yeah, Kim, what a down-to-earth idea.
Kim Eun-young, I guess.
High school teacher. Good man.
Well, I think it's just the culture has driven him there because he enjoys the humanities.
Yep.
And he doesn't know what else to do with an English degree, but...
But score baseball games and teach high school.
I think he feels like he had teachers that meant a lot to him.
Yep.
So he can... You know, that's a way to make a difference and model what he saw.
Maybe, you know, I'm hearing a lot of junior high kids say things like, I'm going to play video games and watch people, and people will pay to watch me. And maybe by the time they get to be 19, there's more hope for them.
I have a friend and her older daughter is very much like, no, I'm going to be famous. Mm-hmm. And her mom says, well, what do you mean by that? And she doesn't even understand the question.
What do you mean? What do I mean?
Yeah, like, well, I'm going to be famous. Like, that's a job. And everybody I see doing that job is doing great. Like, don't bother me with details about which platform that's on or which hashtags make it possible. Like, that's, you know, that's detail work. I've already decided I'm going to be famous.
It's, it's a very bizarre world. It cannot, the center cannot hold, Ken. Not everyone can be famous. You and I can still be famous.
But only us.
We've taken up the last rung of famousness behind us.
We have the only sensible level of it.
Right. I mean, yes. It's, you're more famous.
But still, yeah.
But you're also better adjusted.
We're the allowable spectrum.
Okay, I'm the low end of what what you could even call famous.
That's acceptable.
Yeah.
And then I'm on a niche TV show.
Yeah,
that's the high end of what's acceptable.
You're in a weird kind of famous where nobody can touch you. That's the best thing about you. You're in Hollywood, but Hollywood can't get to you.
Yeah. I mean, right? I guess I could have chosen to move there.
Yeah.
And you know, start taking improv classes. But
even then, improv classes.
What, you're saying I couldn't have made it? You're like, even then.
Oh, man. I'm trying to picture that show, going to the Ass Cats show with Ken Riffin. Pretty hot.
Do you think we would call ourselves the Ass Cats?
Well, you know, what do? You and I except improv. That's all we're doing.
I mean, podcasting has really lowered the bar for what for what constitutes an entertainer or indeed entertainment.
Thank God. Actually, today I got an email from my publisher saying, hey, there's a movie, a new film that's a supernatural thriller, and they want to use one of your songs in the movie, and then it's going to earn you money.
Are they saying that so as not to say a horror movie? Like, why are they saying it's a supernatural thriller?
Supernatural.
Can you imagine asking your date if they want to go to a supernatural thriller tonight?
Going on a date with me is like a supernatural thriller.
What are your favorite supernatural thrillers? Do you enjoy supernatural?
Well,
thrillers?
I mean, Sixth Sense, I think, is a supernatural thriller. But the idea—it just occurred to me, like, every once in a while, I get these emails that it's like it's a reminder that I'm not just a podcaster. I still get my songs used in horror movies, and that is kind of a big deal.
I mean, almost, like, I think it's my generationally, I believe that no one who is actually a musician should ever settle for being a podcaster.
Yeah.
Even if it has turned out that podcaster is actually more remunerative and prestigious than being a musician in most cases.
There's so many great musicians in this town that are, like, working as carpenters. It's embarrassing.
Well, Seattle needs carpenters, honestly.
Seattle does need carpenters.
Good luck
plumbers.
Trying to get your kitchen done in less than 18 months out nowadays.
If you've got someone working on your house in Seattle, maybe over the course of the week, ask them if they
play
guitar.
Ask them which band they played bass in, and you might have heard of it. I was probably in the middle of doing the outro.
I don't even remember. Are we still... Yeah, the show seems to still be recording, so we must be still making an episode.
Why are we still here? This is our existence now.
Shouldn't we be doing something else? It's already almost four.
This is like some Pirandello or Sartre play where two people are talking and then they spend the rest of the play trying to remember if they're still doing their podcast or not.
Are we still in this play?
Did I say anything about the social media still exists?
Don't think so.
No, I think you immediately went into your mom's childhood.
Oh, that sounds like me.
And then...
That's the kind of not very famous I am.
Well, if I said any of this before, I apologize. I'm no longer, you know, 10 years ahead of grade reading level like I once was. It's all... The gray matter is starting to go.
I think any listener, regular listener to the program that stays after... One of us says, and that concludes. Anyone that's ever made it past that and is still here now, they have no expectations.
You're like the kids that stay or are staying after class. Look, everybody else is out on the playground. Why are you still listening to this?
Other people have clicked over to their other
Do you think podcasts. We're going to ask you to help clear erasers if you stay in?
No, because they're all looking at their the counter on their podcast player, and they're going, this isn't even close to the longest outro they've ever done.
So apologies if I already said this, but at social media, which sucks, at Omnibus Project, at Ken Jennings, at John Roderick, email at, what's it, theomnibusproject@gmail.com. Constantly I have people writing to the show to be like, would you guys like this? And I'm like, yeah, send us that. And they say, great, where should I send it to? These are the people who go out to recess immediately, because every single show we mention P.O. Box 55744. Shoreline, yeah. Washington 98155. It's iconic with millennials. They can't remember the Zoom address anymore because they just remember our P.O. box.
Where should I send it to? It's just incredible. Somebody sent me something the other day. They were like, hey, I'm going to see your two friends at this theater. You should come. And I'm like, the two friends that I talk about all the time as having abandoned and betrayed me 3 years ago? Did you not... You're obviously following me closely enough to want to be in regular contact, and yet not closely enough to have remembered that.
Maybe they're a few years behind.
Small detail?
In your oeuvre.
I'm not going to join you at that show to go watch the two people that normally I would have been on the show, and now I'm not.
Blah, blah, blah. What did I do? Patreon. The Patreon is patreon.com/omnibusproject. You can find Futurelings. Wherever Futurelings are sold online, there's a Facebook group, which is really the only nice place on Facebook, I think.
Apparently Annie Leibovitz is selling her Upper West Side duplex.
How much?
I just got an alert here.
Does she think you'd like to buy it?
9 years ago, she paid $11 million for it. She's only asking $8.5 million for it now. So I don't know what. I don't know how much blood there is on the walls.
Yeah, what happened up there?
Beats me.
She had an incontinent Springer Spaniel.
Nobody wants to live on the Upper West Side.
It cost her $3 million.
It's too awkward to live on the Upper West Side because you walk out the door and you're like, oh, God, I just have to apologize to everybody for everything.
Plus, there's a coven downstairs that wants to turn your baby into the Antichrist. That's the main thing keeping properties down on Central Park West now. I think Yoko's selling the apartment where she and John lived, right?
Oh, can we pool our money and get it?
So if you...
Oh, my God. You've never said we more dismissively in your life.
That's not what I meant.
We.
I just meant we, including the listeners. Like, if you donate to patreon.com/omnibusproject at the highest level, if you become a Strawberry Fields donor at the $10 million level... You can come stay with John and me at our new apartment in the Dakota.
Now, what would that take? How much would each Omnibus listener have to donate to the Strawberry Fields Fund in order for us all to buy the Dakota collectively? And then what would it would be like a guru center?
Well, you just do like the Fermi thing of doing the order of magnitude. Let's say 20,000 people are listening to me right now, and let's say you need $20 million to buy that apartment. They just need to each give $1,000.
Yeah, there you go.
It's easy. Yeah. I could be wrong, but I'm not wrong by a factor of 10.
It's easy, and Ken's not wrong by a factor of 10, because he's a boy
genius. I am rarely wrong. I am often wrong, but rarely by a factor of 10. Mm-hmm. What would that even be in daily life? Because you're not even like, does this soup have cloves in it? It would be more like, does this soup have bottle caps in it? Like, like being wrong by that much in daily life is hard. But with math, it's very easy unless you're Kim
Jong-il.
Unless you're Kim Jong-il. That guy can't even count the number of holes in one he gets every time he golfs.
Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. But if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word. Providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.